little man. Don't let them tell you that they have the plan.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. This is a show about critical thinking and related topics. And my name is Bob Frelick. Once again, I'm beaming in remotely via Skype, as is the other host of this show, Julia Minton. Hey, Julia.
Hello from Shelter in Place.
Before we introduce our guest, let's tell folks how they can get in touch with us and pop up our previously archived version of Thinking Clearly.
There's a lot of ways to get a hold of us, and we really like to hear from our listeners. If you're a Facebooker, you can go to Facebook, just search Thinking Clearly. You can find our Facebook page there. If you want to talk to Bob and I directly, you can, we'll message that page or email TC, like Thinking Clearly. And of course, we are podcasted. You can open up your favorite podcast app, just search for a new podcast or ad feed. You know, they're all similar, but not exactly the same. And search Thinking Clearly. You'll find us there. Or thinkingclearly.libsyn.com, where our entire archive of podcasts are.
And we appreciate your feedback. Well, we've got a great guest for this episode of Thinking Clearly, no BS about it. And that's a hint as to what the topic is. How would you frame the topic for this episode, Julia?
Well, along the lines of, you know, the things that we talk about here at Thinking Clearly is identifying the BS and how and when to challenge it. And for those who don't know, BS stands for bull stuff.
We've got FCC requirements, so we're going to abbreviate it. But our guest for this episode of Thinking Clearly is Jevon West with a PhD in biology. Dr. West is an associate professor in the Information School at the University of Washington, where he's also the director of the Center for the Informed Public, and he's the co-director of UW's Data Lab. And he also coordinates the data science education at UW's eScience Institute. A lot of hats there. Welcome, Professor West.
Well, thanks for having me, Bob, and thanks for having me, Julia. I mean, you have the best name for a podcast. In fact, it just reminded me right as you were introducing that I need to put you on our reference list. You should have been already. I'm sorry, but I'm going to. It's just the best name possible for the things that I think about almost every single day.
It's amazing the variety of topics that relate to critical thinking. We don't get into discussing issues on this show. We talk about and focus on the process of critical thinking, but there's so much to critical thinking that folks are beginning to realize and folks are doing in their psychological, sociological, and economic studies. But before we actually saddle up for this episode, I want to remind listeners that around 7:45, 7:50, something like that, we're going to open the phone lines for listeners to call in with their questions or comments about the topic that we're discussing in this episode. And we'll announce that when we get to it, and we'll give the numbers. But Jevon, you are a great guest for us on episode number 10, way back there in April of 2017, when we talked about scientific method. We talked about the importance of science literacy and the course that you were teaching, which I'll phrase as calling BS in the age of big data. And now your colleague and you, your colleague Carl Bergstrom, have a book out which almost has the same name. It's titled Calling BS, The Art of Skepticism. And I do want to point out that, The Art of Skepticism in a Data-Driven World, that's the full title. And I do want to point out that it's really kind of a shame that here, because of FCC broadcast requirements, we have to abbreviate that perfectly wonderful word that you did not abbreviate either in the course or your book. So good for you. But since we talked last, the Center for the Informed Public, which you head up now, and I think that was established around December 2019, I love the statement at the end of the kickoff event that was on the web page for that center. It said something like this. It said, quote, join us in restoring trust in information and each other, end quote. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what motivated the creation of that center and what happens there?
Well, you've done your homework well, Bob. You're absolutely right. It was launched in 2019, in December of 2019. And at that time, we knew we had lots of challenges ahead. We didn't know that a couple months after that, we would be in the middle of a major pandemic. And with any crisis situation, you're surrounded during those times with misinformation and disinformation. So this skill that you talk about in this podcast, about the process of thinking, about the habits of mind that we need, more, it's more important than ever, really. I think we could make a pretty good argument that it's now, of course, we've needed it at all times, but now especially, we really need these skills. And so the center was really about bringing together other colleagues and other organizations on our campus and across our community around this issue of misinformation, disinformation. And so we focus on four main pillars. We focus on research, of course, because that's our area of expertise. We study mostly the ways in which ideas, good and bad, get amplified on social media and online more broadly. So we do research. We do education work. So we put a lot of our effort in education, community engagement, and policy. So we've brought together colleagues from the law school, from engineering, from the information school, from all over campus. And we're part of a national network that's really devoted to this. And so when this pandemic hit us, I wouldn't say we were perfectly prepared because we only had about 2 months to get going on this. But we've been working day and night tracking misinformation around COVID-19, around vaccination misinformation around that. We tracked misinformation around the wildfires that we had on the West Coast, around the social justice movement, around the election, et cetera. And now we're focusing a lot on anti-vaccination misinformation. So that's one of the things we do. But really, we think that a lot of our efforts can't be in just publishing papers and going to academic conferences and talking to our colleagues with it. We need to go out to the public. So I love that that's part of our mission, that we get to go out there and talk to librarians and educators and government officials and industry and the public at large. So that's the center. And it certainly was inspired by the course that my colleague Carl Bergstrom and I did, but it was also inspired by work of my colleagues that have been working on these kinds of things as well for many years.
Can you talk a little bit about what that national movement is? I don't know about that.
Yeah. So thanks for asking. So we received our initial seed funding to start the center. Most universities require, a little bit of seed money to allow you to have a center. And we were fortunate enough to receive funding from the Knight Foundation, who funds this kind of work. Although this is kind of new for them, they fund journalism and they fund local community organizations and all sorts of efforts in those areas. But research is a new thing kind of for them. They've funded research before, but really they invested in this. So they invested about $50 million in lots of projects. I wish we got all that. Well, actually, I don't. I want it spread out. But that wasn't all just us. We received funding of five different centers. So five centers received funding, and then about 14 other research projects across the country in different universities. And that's growing too. So I don't know if they've used their full investment. The point is, they said, we are going to invest a lot into this. We're going to form centers. We're going to fund projects at universities. So it's part of a national effort right now to really dig deep on issues of policy, on research, on education outreach. So here's the thing. We're in a crisis of misinformation. And certainly we've seen the effects during the pandemic with the infodemic that people have been using for about a year now. But the good news among all that kind of bad news or the challenged environment, information environment we're in, is that we do have a lot of people and organizations doing good work, including your podcast too, teaching people how to think clearly in a world where there's just so much information. And I think, I'll claim, or I'll argue very loudly, as loud as I can be on a podcast without not being annoying, is that's one of the best things we can do. Yes, we can throw certain laws and regulation, and that could help, and there could be changes in the platform themselves. We could throw, different kinds of technology at it, and I think a lot of the technologists think they can solve the problem. They can help, certainly, but nothing is going to be better than just becoming better thinkers. And so that's why it's efforts like this that's, I think, the best thing we can do.
Yeah, absolutely. That's really interesting information. I think, people who are familiar with public media have probably heard of the Knight Foundation as well. So it's interesting to hear that they are charting new territory. And I also want to thank you for coming back. It was a simpler time the last time
you
were here.
It was, wasn't it? It's crazy to think that was a simpler time, but it really is relative to what we've been living in the last little while.
Yeah, definitely. I noticed in the preface of your book, you make a distinction between old school BS and new school BS. Could you clarify the differences between those and how you draw that distinction?
Absolutely. So BSing has been happening for centuries, basically from the beginning of human communication. So that's not new. And that usually comes in the form of language and rhetoric. We're used to seeing that just because as humans, we live within these social environments where we pick up on these cues. We kind of can identify when someone's really trying to sell us that car. But there's a new kind of BS that's really on the charge. And that's BS that comes wrapped in data and numbers and infographics and data graphics and algorithms. And those kinds of forms are more intimidating. And I don't think we've had the time to get as good at calling BS on that form of misinformation as much as we had the language and rhetoric. So these would be things like, if I started throwing out things like, and I ran this random forest algorithm and I got this result, or I got this sort of p-value, or I did a Bonferroni correction and I got this result, people start to go, oh, well, they must be right because they're using all this fancy jargon or all these fancy numbers, or they showed me this really, complicated looking infographic. It must be right. And it's that form that can cause just as much problems. And we've seen that actually during the pandemic. You've seen charts and numbers and graphs. Sometimes they're fine and defendable, but there's been so much of it, sometimes by honest mistake and sometimes a little bit more nefarious, where we've seen that kind of information be used to make arguments that are specious. So we really just need to get better at dealing with that. And so really, what Carl and I, my co-author of the book, really wanted to do was empower everyone to be able to call BS on this new kind of BS that we're seeing more of this data BS. And we do it assuming that most people by a large margin don't have a PhD in statistics or an advanced degree in computer science and machine learning or in any of these quantitative fields that use these kinds of things all the time, that anyone can do it. So really, we see the book in a self-help section, empowering people, feeling more confident about themselves that they can do that. And that, to me, nothing gives me more joy than teaching someone how to identify the tricks and of infographics or the ways in which percentages and unfair comparisons are crop up in almost, it seems like, every day in every single newspaper. So that's the difference between old school and new school BS.
Yeah, that makes sense. I've run across some of that new school BS. And, there are times when it's like, do I really have the time and energy to start digging into this and figuring out what's going on? So I can see it how it has different sets of challenges to break through. I know when I think of what is BS, or the first thing that comes to my mind about what BS looks like, may not be the same for Bob or for you. So I guess I'll pose the question to you, what are some of your favorite examples of BS, and how would you detect it as such? How do you smell it, if you will?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's also a hard question because there's so much out there to narrow it to one. So how about I'll give you just a couple examples in different kinds of flavors. So speaking of numbers and graphics, one form of BSing through data graphics is the misuse, sometimes accidental and sometimes on purpose, of cumulative graphs. These are graphs where you look at the sum of some quantity and you keep adding to it. So it's just a sum of everything else that's happened in the past. So this might be the number of iPhone cell phones that you see over time. And one of our first lectures we ever did was we showed this graphic of Tim Cook when he just recently took over Apple and was talking about this explosive growth of iPhone sales. But he was using a cumulative graph. And if you actually looked at the quarterly sales of those iPhones, you'd see a much different story. So there is this, that's a form of BSing. Look at this explosive growth. And in fact, we did that as a joke in our very first lecture many years ago when we did this. We showed this cumulative growth of our website, of the course that we have, which there was growth and it was fun to see, but it certainly wasn't explosive after a certain amount of time. But we used a cumulative plot just to say, hey, look at this. But let me give you a specific example from my own field. This is one of my favorite quotes that Carl and I like to share when giving an example of BS after we give a definition of what BS is. And our definition really, it sort of sits, it's evolving all the time, but it involves the language and statistics and data graphics and really any form of presentation that's intended to impress, overwhelm, or persuade with kind of a blatant disregard for truth. So here, listen to this quote by Sigmund Freud. This came from his writings, you know, many, many, many years ago. So he writes, "So I gave my lecture yesterday, despite a lack of preparation, I spoke quite well and without hesitation, which I ascribe to the cocaine I had taken beforehand. I told about my discoveries in brain anatomy, all very difficult things that the audience certainly didn't understand. But all that matters is that they get the impression that I understand it." That to me, and to Carl, of course, is an example from our own world. So we have to make fun of ourselves because BS comes in all forms and all industries. That was an example of intending to impress or overwhelm and presented with a blatant disregard for whatever information is being conveyed. Freud just wanted to show that he was smart, and it had nothing to do with the information itself and was just kind of trying to garner attention and to use this as a persuasive measure. And we see this in sort of non-human ways too. So the platforms themselves, so the social media platforms, in many ways, I consider kind of the biggest large-scale BSers of all time, because they don't care what content you're getting. They just want to suck you in, to attract you, to sort of grab your attention, which is very much what you see the typical BSer in a bar telling stories of things that just aren't true, but they're just trying to attract your attention. They don't care what they're saying. They just want to show you, hey, I'm cool and I'm fun to talk to. Well, the platforms are similar in that they don't care what you see, whether it's a conspiracy theory video or a very high-quality National Geographic video on, you know, the newest dinosaur found or something. All it cares is it's grabbing your attention. And I think that's one of the problems, is we have these platforms that are quite BSers themselves. So plenty of other examples, but those are a couple of examples that I like. And I'm happy to share others if we have time.
Well, I've got to say that I haven't heard Freud quoted for quite some time.
Well, I had to fill that long gap then, Bob.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of varying opinions about this, about the level of current misinformation that we're exposed to. Would you say that we're being exposed to misinformation at about the same level as 20 years ago, or slightly more, or a lot more misinformation being sent our way?
Well, measuring misinformation is a very difficult task, and we've been trying to do it in our lab, and other researchers that work in this area also have been working on it. So I'd have to say from the beginning, it's actually really hard to measure. But if we could measure it, or since we can't measure it, I can at least speculate and argue that I do think we're seeing more of it at higher density, partly because we're just seeing information at higher volumes, period. We all are, we're digesting more information from our phones every extra second that we have. We have computers in front of us that are constantly popping up and telling us this new notification of this new story, this new email, this new social media post. We have more information, and it's easier to amplify misinformation, much easier than it was before, when you had to have a print business, you had to have an audience established. There was a huge investment to get a big audience, and if you had it, you certainly could BS, and that was happening clearly before, you know, the internet or Web 2.0. But today, when you have bots and algorithms sifting things to you that many times are far from the truth, when you have, you know, bad state actors and propagandists and opportunists and conspiracy theorists using this powerful tool to do what they do, which isn't good for society. But then you also have all the honest degradations of information out there, and it can degrade fast as we spread these pieces of information without context, without depth, without even reading the article. We're all guilty of not reading the article at times and sharing, which is one of the things we need to do, is think more, think clearly, and share less. That's one thing we always say in our center: think more, share less. Maybe we should say think clearly and share less. But yeah, so I do think we are seeing more of it than we were before. And it's more challenging than ever. And what's interesting is, you know, there's a lot of discussion right now with platform moderation. And I think we should be having this discussion as a society. I think there's good arguments for why we need to go further. And there's good arguments for being careful, given sort of at least my respect to the First Amendment. But what's interesting about this particular topic, when people have been yelling, you know, about censorship and fair and sometimes fair arguments, that there is freedom of speech, but it doesn't necessarily apply to the platforms, but it protects the platforms, interestingly. And even if it was just on this issue of free speech, what's interesting is there is such thing as free speech, but maybe not far free reach or whatever. This isn't my term. I think it's a lovely term. My colleague Kate Starbird, who I work with, used this recently, that the tools that are available doesn't mean there's any, you know, human right that everyone has to have a microphone to get everything out there, but they think they do, and they have recently, and what those microphones do that can amplify and spread misinformation, you know, within minutes across the world, that makes for an environment where we are running into a lot of it. So in some, yes, Bob, I do think we are contending with more BS today than we ever have, just mainly because of the volume and the technology that allows for it.
I was kind of surprised to see that there are some researchers that claim that there isn't a great deal more misinformation, but because it seems so intuitive that one of the differences is the push technology. You had to subscribe to a newspaper. You didn't get them pushed at you like it is so easily done now. People have feeds, news feeds. They have shares that are pushed at them. So it's that push technology, I think, that's in my opinion, that's really accelerated it.
I completely agree. I mean, one of the more damaging things to society, it seems so simple, but it really is that share and the like button when there's no, especially when there's no requirement of editorialship or gatekeeping or any editorial process. And trained journalists, they make mistakes, but at least they have training, reputations at hand, and they do some vetting, at least the ones that, certainly follow basic rule sets. When everyone now is a producer and consumer of this information and have to be editors as well, that the push technology, just as you say, Bob, I think is one of the things that is at the root of a lot of this. And I mean, you know, it's connected to a lot of these aspects of technology, but that's why, again, if people would just think clearly and share less, I think we start to attack the problem a little bit.
Well, Julia and I might disagree somewhat about this. I'll be interested what her opinion is. But what I've mostly gone to is to turn off any feeds that I can turn off. I don't have a news feed, and I use the internet mainly to harness the power of its pull technology. I love the internet because I can pull information out of it so quickly. When I went to graduate school, I had to go to the library and look up through stacks of indices, you know, to get the information. I can just reach over and punch a few keys and get all kinds of good information. So that's the pull, you know, you're pulling information that you want and you choose and you need. And so I do that. I very seldom do likes. What I share is I share this show from our Facebook page. I use the push technology very lightly. Julie, do you have an opinion?
I like that. Oh, yeah, I'd love to hear what Julie says.
Yeah, I would too.
Because it is interesting. Maybe we should come up with a formula right now on the show. Right now is just what that balance should be. There's like these, in chemistry, you learn about balancing these different equations. Maybe there's some sort of equation we could balance between push and pulls. Because you're right. I mean, the pull is amazing. I do miss the library too and those sort of, you know, serendipitous interactions with different books that you run into that you didn't come to the library initially
sure.
for. I miss those, and you kind of lose that a little bit. You know, but it is amazing. And what's amazing is you would think in a world where we can access that good information so easily that misinformation would go down, because you could be at a dinner conversation, and if someone says something wrong, you could say, you really say that? You can look it up. But we're actually in a worse situation, even with all this good information. But Julia, tell us your thoughts on that.
Well, first I'll say, Bob, we're all entitled to our opinions, okay? Okay. I'm saying that tongue in cheek. I don't know. I won't dig into it too much. I personally use social media. I've been using the internet since back before dawn when it was BBSs and Gopher and Usenet. To me, it's a tool, you know, and much like a hammer, you can build a house or you can bludgeon someone. And frankly, to me, that's what the internet is. I think, Bob, you make a really good point about the push-pull technology. A lot of us are being subjected to the push of the internet, whether we know it or not, whether we even know better. But the pull also is a vulnerability, because what a lot of us do, and I am 100% guilty of this, is I go on the internet and I look for what I want and I pull that in, because it's what I'm looking for and it's what agrees with me. It's the confirmation bias, right? I absolutely agree. What I miss is the browsing the library and stumbling to some section that I never would have even wanted to have stumbled in, or and to discover something new. And that is really hard on the internet. I tried doing that on Wikipedia sometimes. By the way, there's a little link where you can get random articles on Wikipedia, and that's really kind of fun.
It is. And you know what's interesting about that, too, is that in the library, you didn't have this other force pulling you. You could sort of, you're going to get a book and then you find yourself in this other shelf and then you sort of are looking through. Whereas today's information world, there are these algorithms that have been doing a gazillion different experiments, tapping into your psychology to figure out how to pull you into areas that are just about advertising dollars and about sort of these, you know, videos or stories that are sensational and eye-catching, but really might not be of any quality. And certainly if you look at YouTube, and even certainly before they made some corrections over the last couple of years, that it was just filtered. You get one or two kind of recommendations and you're already down this rabbit hole to conspiracy theory videos. And you didn't get that as much in the library. If you went randomly walking and got pulled somewhere, it wasn't necessarily really horrible conspiracy theory or even crazy ones like flat earthers. I mean, whatever it could be. But now we have that force against us. And also I find that these algorithms are great when we're tired too, when we're tired and we can easily get pulled by some headline or by some image that is eye candy, and you just get pulled in. And it's usually, a result of these algorithms knowing exactly how to tap into that sort of thing, because they're running these experiments, these A/B experiments all the time. And that's a good thing about the library. We don't have that part. So, but it is good with the Wikipedia having these random. I've used that too. It is kind of nice. You kind of recreated a little bit there.
Yeah, absolutely. And part of it's understanding, you know, what it is we're working with. Libraries, you know, have a long history of kind of a public good, where I think a lot of people don't even realize that, you know, when you're on social media, you are the product. Kind of the other way around.
Isn't that interesting? And that's going to be a serious topic over the next year or two within policy discussions. Right now, in fact, there was discussions in many meetings and conferences, even Friday this week, about that very topic, about the commoditization of just our attention, our time, our, like, us as individual, we are the product. If those have seen the social dilemma, that was a pretty popular documentary over the last 6 months, and people have looked at it and they talk about this. But you know, people, you know, and scholars have been talking about that, you know, for a long time. The important thing is now to make users at least aware of that. So some users will say, well, fine, okay, I'm a product, but I get all this free stuff, but at an expense to other people would consider a pretty high expense. So this is just a discussion we need to have, because it really has been flipped, as you said, Julia. It really has.
And I thought you brought up a good point earlier, too, which is just the sheer quantity of information. I mean, there's a reason we're now in the information age. You know, this isn't, industrialization's gone to the wayside, and information actually becomes an industry, and it becomes, it's in our lives more, you know, as you said, presenting all this information. You know, and to that, you know, Bob and I on this show have often talked about information pollution, you know, and how the information environment that we're in can become polluted with things that are untrue, misinformation, or intentional disinformation. So I guess I would ask, how have the sources of misinformation and disinformation changed over the years? And I would also ask, how has misinformation and disinformation changed as the pool of information grows?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I do like this analogy of pollution. And it's also, I think a somewhat of a positive story when we compare it, let's say, to the environmental movement, when they were, we look out on our roads and our waterways and, and certainly in the air as a result of the Industrial Revolution, there was a lot of pollution. And I think we're working through that. We're working through some growing pains in society with this new tool that we have. And now this information economy and this information environment in which we all live and spend more of our time there than even in the physical world, sadly. But the sources are changing in that individuals that would never have had the amplification potential that they do now, it creates a lot more opportunities for some of these bad actors, we'll call them, that want to push conspiracy theories or propaganda. But again, I always want to remind people that yes, there are bad actors out there, and we study those and we've monitored that kind of activity. But a lot of the information out there is just due to degradation and for people just trying to do collective sense making during environments and times when there is uncertainty, like this pandemic. People want the most current information, and science, for example, can't gather that information fast enough. So what do? They go to the newspapers. Well, they can't report on it yet because science still hasn't figured out in the last 2 hours. So where do I go? I go to Twitter or I go to one of these social media platforms. And there are plenty of people that will give you an answer if you want an answer. So there's just a lot more actors out there. Now, there are professional conspiracy theorists out there, and they do have influence on the spread of misinformation. There are high influencers on social media that can use their presence online to push messages that they don't even create. So we saw that a lot during the U.S. election. We're a nonpartisan center, so we see things from the left and right. But we certainly saw it generally where you'd see individuals pushing certain kinds of narratives that they don't even create. So things bubble up, but with that, there's a power that you have as an influencer online, and you can push things, and then being verified and being influential, a lot of the algorithms will sort of upweight some of the things that you post, and so that becomes problematic. And then you also have these ways of automating misinformation through bots and other means. And so these sources of information really, really have kind of changed, because before, you could push propaganda if you own the media. And there are certainly places around the world where there's state sponsored and state owned media. But nothing has ever been as powerful as social media. In fact, one of the things that my colleagues and I, we kind of joke about, it's not really a joke. It's kind of a sad, sick joke. But there is something called the Fermi paradox. And this is this idea that with the billions and billions of stars out there and the billions and billions and more than that, of course, planets out there, why isn't that we haven't seen another form of life at this point? There might be lots of explanations, but one explanation some people say is that, okay, any civilized society eventually matures enough and they just basically self-destruct with, nuclear weapons or whatever. And our joke is they probably just discovered social media. And that's what sort of self-destructed the society. It's kind of a sad way of thinking about the world right now, but it really is. I think, social media is sort of at the root of it. And the sources that we see are typically what we call repeat offenders too. So these are individuals that continue to push misinformation, blatant misinformation, disinformation, intentional misinformation. And the social media companies haven't really done anything about it until now. Actually, there has been, and it's been controversial, certainly. And there, again, this is a discussion point that the society should have. But those individuals that keep doing this, there's been some proactive activity on social media, and you kind of see it partly because of shifting power winds, in the political sphere. So it makes a lot of us a little more cynical about what these reactions themselves. But the point is, there are the people that actually spread the most amount of information. They're not a huge group. They're usually a smaller group that just have an enormous amount of information or influence on social media, and they keep doing it over and over.
This is sort of a good time to get into a quote that I found frightening in your book, because it's kind of my worst nightmare. And it goes like this: when the divide between political factions grows deep enough, conversation between them stop, our trust in people and institution erodes, we lose faith in our ability to make collective decisions. Ultimately, we start to question the democratic process itself. And it seems that we came pretty close to that description on January 6th of this year. Are we really staring into that precipice? And what can we do to avoid falling into that abyss?
I wish I had a more positive answer for you, Bob, because I'm an optimist by nature, but this does concern me. And when Carl and I wrote that, we took that statement very seriously. And it's probably, to me, the thing that we should be most concerned about. It's not any individual propaganda campaign. It's not any individual out there per se. It's not any individual news story that scares me most. It's just the erosion of trust that we have now in institutions generally, journalism, government, any of these major institutions in which we depend. The trust in those are going down. Doesn't matter which metric or survey you use, whether you use Pew Research or any of these other major survey firms that have been doing this for years and years. Trust among not just Americans in these institutions, but across the world, has been going down. And really, if you look at the goal of a lot of disinformation campaigns, it's not to pick Biden over Trump or Trump over Biden, or it's not about one or the other, one side or the other, or one side of an argument or another. It's just very much about dividing, about exacerbating differences, about vilifying the other side, about not getting along or trusting each other. And so to me, that's the thing that scares me the most. When I go talk to the younger generation, when I talk to high schoolers and middle schoolers, the comment that does bother me the most is when students will say, well, I don't believe anything. And nothing out there is true. And that is the precipice, that we need to be able to know that there is such thing as fact. There are ways in which we can go about knowing things in the world, that we do need to trust in experts to some degree. They don't always get it right, but we do rely on that. And we do rely on these institutions within a democracy. And so to me, it's that trust, those trust indicators that I'm sort of watching closely. In fact, we hired a postdoctoral scholar, Rachel Moran from USC Annenberg School, who's now focused entirely on thinking about trust in media and institutions. And I've learned so much thinking about this too. And it's trust in ourselves and in institutions that is to me the most concerning.
I do every once in a while look at my Facebook feed and things that are shared just to sort of keep tabs on what the zeitgeist is going on there. And I, from a person who does a lot of pro-Trump posts, I saw something like, I'm not going to give you the exact quote, but it's something like, fascists have historically controlled information, and now we have fact-checking.
Right. Yeah.
Meaning that fact-checking itself, not something you should trust, you know?
I know.
So where does that leave you?
In fact, we've worked with some of the fact-checking organizations. And first of all, it's a really hard job. You just have to roll up your sleeves and get to work. And the processes aren't that complicated. You're sort of laying your trails for how you came to some conclusion. And most often, by the way, it's never true or false. It's always usually somewhere in the middle. But at least that was your backup stop. Like if it's baseball's our analogy, that's your backup player, you know, as a throw is coming into the catcher so that you have a backup back there. That's your fact checker. And if we can't even trust the fact checkers, we are in trouble. And if we only retreat to our nearest neighbors on social media or our nearest neighbors in the physical world, that's not enough for us to get a sense of really what's true and what's not out there. And certainly people should be skeptical and they should ask questions. But we have to have some agreed upon norms and institutions by which we can have these conversations, disagree at times, and in fact, lots of times, but hopefully be able to do it in a way where we're trying to be smarter collectively, not just trying to look smart. Actually, we end the book very much about this when talking about the refutation part of BS. We say, you know, calling BS is not necessarily about making ourselves look smarter. There's a real civicness behind it if you're doing it responsibly. It's very much about making us all smarter. So I might disagree with you about the nuances of the newest tax bill, let's say, but I want you to have the best information because maybe your argument's right. And then it will clarify my thinking and then we're all better off. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think this is something that that definitely concerns me and I think we need to be thinking about as well.
Well, we're getting close to opening the phone lines, but I think Julia probably has another question before we actually give the phone numbers.
Yeah. Well, as I was alluding to before, there is that expression that, well, you're entitled to your opinion or everyone's opinion is equally valid, which, I mean, side note, I feel like when people say that, they often don't mean it. It's a way to kind of say like, oh, let's, you know, be dismissive and get along. But, you know, it is something that's very common in communication, especially these days as the divide is very deep. So my question is, how tolerant should we be of other people's opinions, especially when we, you know, smell BS on those opinions? And like, what would be your personal advice or your guidelines as to when to push back and when to just let it go and say, well, we're all entitled to our opinions?
Well, so it's a good and important question, something I think about all the time. And I'll preface it by saying this is easier said than done. But I really do wish that we could bring more empathy to the conversations that we see online. I think it's become so caustic and so driven by, you know, sort of mob mentality on all sides of the political spectrum, certainly, and across social media. I wish we would engage in more genuine conversations where we assume that the person on the other side isn't, you know, malice isn't at root, that if they are saying something I don't agree with and I smell the BS, as you say, that maybe it's because of honest mistake or incompetence. I mean, it could be incompetence, but it's certainly, we shouldn't start with malice. I mean, there's sometimes, you know, you can legitimately conclude that it is malice at the root of it, but I think that's rare. And so I think we should be more open, more empathetic, try at least to have conversations and see the other side have a productive conversation. But that's hard too, because we're just constantly distracted and we don't engage as much like we would if we, you know, were talking to our neighbor. We certainly know that trolls online don't behave the same most often in person as they do do in sort of the after an article in the newspaper or something. You see all this troll behavior everywhere else. But I think there are times though when you just have to say, all right, I can't convince this person. It's the gulf may be too wide, and then sort of maybe look to the next individual to try to make progress. But I think the one thing we need to do is make sure that, you know, that we're not the ones, because we all BS. In fact, one of the things that we talk to our students is we want to be BS neutral, like carbon neutral. You know, we want to be able to refute as much as we produce. But it doesn't mean that we refute everything we see. And it doesn't mean we're always at the table going, nah, you know, contradicting everything everyone's saying. But you have to pick and choose, and you have to make sure you're right. You have to be clear. There are methods by which you do this. And you need to do this with civics and knowing there's a human on the other side. And so I think bringing a little more empathy would be helpful in these collective conversations.
What you just said brings to mind a follow-up question that I will ask you, but let's go ahead and open up the phone lines. So while we're waiting for callers to get on the line, Jevon, are you still teaching that course at the University of Washington?
I sure am, with my colleague and friend Carl Bergstrom. We just finished it just last quarter. So we teach it winter or fall quarter. We're on a quarter system at the university. And it is one of my favorite classes. It is my favorite class. I love teaching it with students because we have students from across the campus from over 40 different majors. We get to talk about what I consider probably the most important thing they can learn in college, which is being able to call BS when they, or at least spot it when they see it, and then refute it and call it also at times as well. But yeah, I think it's really fun to teach, and I truly think it's one of the more important classes that I personally teach.
I'm just going to interrupt and say it looks like we do have a caller.
Okay. Caller.
Fantastic. Thanks welcome for
to,
listening.
Welcome to Thinking Clearly. It's on
great.
Your mind.
So I'm going to just read what I wrote really quick. So just give me a quick moment. I'm sorry about
sure.
that. So as an educator, I'm finding myself in my teaching directive leaving the realm of developing skills to participate economically and more towards developing skills of participating in a democracy. So I'd love to hear about your Calling BS course, and in particular, what advice you have for getting students to communicating with policy and decision makers to realize actual change. And then secondly, just another topic, I'd love to hear about the role of media misinformation in this last week's GameStop Wall Street Bets short squeeze fiasco.
Thanks for calling, Kyle. And actually, all of our information, we make it freely available. So you can go to our website. I won't say the full one because I don't want to get Julia and Bob fined, but callingbs.org. And then we have all sorts of case studies and examples and videos, and we put up more all the time. So feel free to use anything that we have. But I love your idea of switching it from this, you know, to really shifting to sort of engaging in the democratic process. Certainly that also leads to economic value as well. But I think in doing so, people will realize that they can move to those gatekeepers, the primary, let's say a primary information producer in medicine or a primary information producer in any sort of industry, and engaging and really bringing civics back. So we talk in our class, we actually start our class with good old fashioned discussions of civics. I mean, this was something that was standard in most education curriculum way back when, and we've kind of gone away from it. But now we almost need this new discussion about civics in online formats. And so talking about that, talking about media literacy, talking about sort of the importance of that democratic discourse, and about, you know, what that means, and that they can be the producers. In fact, one of these great programs, it's actually close to where you guys are at KQED in San Francisco, has this great program where they go out with high schoolers and they teach them how to be journalists, even though most of them will never be journalists. But just the action of having to do fact-checking, to have to tell a story, to see how difficult that can be, it certainly gives them an appreciation and a little bit more trust in those that do this reliably. So I love your focus on that, Kyle, and feel free to reach out to me. I think that would be great. Now, in regards to that, the craziness of and the misinformation about this pushback on Wall Street. I mean, what an amazing story! I've been following it mostly as a consumer. We usually track a lot of these different events in our lab and in our center. So we'll track, let's say, when COVID starts, we start collecting a bunch of information on that. We haven't collected as much on there, so I don't have as much to say as I usually would on certain kinds of topics. But one of the things we do study is the virality of and the sort of collective behavior. Actually, we hired a new scholar who spent his entire career studying the swarming of fish and how they can get sort of misdirected by just a few little different sort of fish going one way and some going the other way. And so he understands sort of the mathematics of it. And so watching this sort of collective behavior around these kinds of events. Now, the misinformation all by itself is interesting in that you have you have top-down misinformation. So you have misinformation that can come from, you know, the major broadcasters or from newspapers or whatever that have a lot of influence. But then you have this sort of bottom-up too that happens that can then get picked and pulled. But yeah, no, what an interesting story altogether. The actual misinformation around that, I can't say as much about because I usually I'm right on top of this one. I've been only just watching sort of the chaotic sort of discussions I'm sure that are going on in the regulatory offices right now after all that happened. But there's some serious issues around that as well.
Let me piggyback on Kyle's question. We will link to those resources that Jevin talked about and to how you can get in touch with Jevin. But I'm interested in when students take that class, what are their reactions? Do you see them going out? Do you see a change in them? Do you have some that get obnoxious about it and are calling BS wherever they see it? How do you teach them to appropriately call BS and how to do it in a way that's going to be productive?
Absolutely. So we actually end the class, we'll end it, meaning several weeks worth of efforts, on the calling part of it. Because there's a spotting part of the class where we talk about spotting BS, but then there's the calling part. And very much at the calling part is being a responsible caller of it, to pick and choose when you do it, to not be what we call the well actually guy that's always there just to say, well, actually, we don't want that. We want people that are, again, making all of us smarter, to pick and choose, to make sure that you're clear, to make sure you're right, to admit fault, to don't double down and triple down like we see all the time on the internet nowadays. I mean, some of these basic rules of civics online that I think we need to ingrain more in all of us. But I will say it is so joyful to see the excitement that students get. Now, we talk about selection bias in our class, which is, you know, an issue. So you're going to hear a selection bias issue here. But the students I've talked to that come to me all say, you know, that it's really great. But maybe there's other students that took it that didn't think it was great. But our reaction overall, I would say, you know, if I was trying to be as impartial as possible, I think it's one of those courses that a lot of students, and actually we've seen, let's say, with a lot of students that, you know, might come from cultures where you don't question authority as much, too. That's been interesting to see how students have, you know, have talked about that and talked just generally about this idea of questioning some of the information that they're seeing. So that's been interesting by itself. But I would say, yes, students feel empowered. I mean, here's an example. You know, one of the things we talk about are, you know, if it sounds too good to be true, you know, or too bad to be true, it probably is. I can't tell you how many students have come up to me and say, this sounds too good to be, and it is. And so they come running in and they'll show me a headline that they found. So it's really great to see that in students. In fact, even just the basic tools, like showing them ways in which data graphics are manipulated from the y-axis and x-axis and all the kind of things to look at. I'll get emails from them all the time, even from former students. Look at this example. Look at this example. So it's great to see that. And I do think the reaction has been overall quite positive.
Okay. Well, I don't think we have any other callers. So let me ask this, and we're coming up on the top of the hour here. But one of the things that was I really found interesting in your book is that talking about internet publishing, since internet publishing became prevalent. And here's a quote from your book. It's, today, a rudimentary understanding of web design and a willingness to defraud people is all it takes to become a predatory publisher. That's such a catching name, predatory publisher. I didn't really know anything about that. Just say a little bit about that.
Yes. So, and we're seeing it in all areas, including science, which is, it's one of my, I'm a huge fan of science ever since I was a little kid. And even science has been affected by these predatory publishers. And so these publishers go out and look like they're a science publisher, or predatory publishers in general look very official. They have a professional looking website. They look like they're a legitimate, peer-reviewed kind of institution that's sifting through the good and bad information, but they're there just to make money or push a message, and it's really hurting. In fact, the growth of predatory publishing in science is quite concerning, especially for the public that's engaging with science. They'll see this and they'll assume, this is a science journal. It's not. And that just that ability to create a webpage with very little money and very little investment gives people this what looks like a very nice front door to their, you know, online office, and you dig a little bit deeper, and there's nothing legitimate about them, but they're able to spread misinformation pretty easily. So it is, we're in a world where it just takes a little bit extra effort to figure out, you know, the legitimate publishers and the legitimate information and the less legitimate versions.
Do you have a, off the top of your head, good resource for vetting journals?
Yes, actually, we have one in our website. We post it on our website. So Carl Bergstrom and I actually spent several years developing different metrics for evaluating legitimate journals and non-legitimate journals. And we have one article devoted to this on the Calling BS website where we say, here's a few tips to look for if you are looking at science, here a science journal or science article. Here are a few tips to look out for. And so you can go to our website and you can find that, and I can send it to you, Bob and Julia, yeah. And it'll be available.
Great. Send me that link. And that about does it for us. Much more to talk about and think about, but I want to thank our guest, Jevin West, very much, and I wish you good fortune in 2021 and with your book and your wonderful work at the University of Washington and in your personal life journey. And we're going to post a number of links on our Facebook page to you, including a link to the book, Calling BS, The Art of Skepticism in a Data-Driven World, and to the Center for the Informed Public. So, Jevin, thank you very much.
Thanks so much, Bob, and thanks so much, Julie. It's been a joy, and thank you for all the work you're doing and all the listeners that hung out with us tonight.
All right. We want to thank our wonderful engineer, Sue Maloney, and to everyone listening to both this live broadcast and the podcast. We couldn't do it without you folks, and we'd love to get feedback from you. And as always, thank you, Julia.
And thank you, Bob.
Keep thinking clearly.
This is a lot hotter on Skype. Think for yourself, people. It's your first and your last chance.
This program was produced in KMUD's Redway Studio and is provided courtesy of KMUD, Redwood Community Radio.